It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, the Federal Reserve is raising the interest rate. We'll check out the possible impact and why that's just one factor influencing where inflation goes from here. First, the La Crosse-based utility company Dairyland Power Cooperative is exploring the idea of adding nuclear energy back to its power grid. They're working with a nuclear reactor company to see if it would be possible to install a new, smaller reactor in one of Dairyland's current sites as an additional source of energy. Still in the idea stage, but it's the first sign of interest in nuclear energy since the Wisconsin state legislature removed the effective ban on building new nuclear plants in 2016. Wisconsin currently has one nuclear power plant still in operation. We're learning more now about the proposal and how nuclear could fit into Wisconsin's energy future. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you heard about this particular nuclear reactor discussion in the La Crosse area? What questions do you have about it? Do you think nuclear energy should be a bigger part of the energy mix here in Wisconsin? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. Paul Wilson is the Granger Professor of Nuclear Engineering and the chair of the University of Wisconsin-Madison's Department of Engineering Physics. Paul, thanks for joining us today.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here.
Can you talk about this sort of new model nuclear power plant? What could it look like? How it would be different from the nuclear power plants of the past?
Sure. So this concept is being developed by a company called NuScale, and they're the first in line, really, to deploy these new, smaller reactors. This reactor here would be 10 or 20 times smaller than the large reactors we have up at Point Beach or other places around the country. About the same size, in fact, as the La Crosse boiling water reactor that Dairyland Power operated in the 70s and 80s. But I think more important than its size is the way that it's designed. It's much smaller in its physical size. And so it's designed so that it can be built in a factory and shipped to the site. And hopefully that will make things cheaper in the long run once we build many of these kinds of reactors. It also makes it a little easier to start up. You can buy one reactor that's small and start making some money once you're selling the electricity and use that revenue to help you build and maybe build five or six small reactors on your site.
Nuclear power used to be a little more common in Wisconsin. You just mentioned the Point Beach reactor, the only one still going now. What led to the decline of nuclear power here in the state?
So one of the challenges for some nuclear power plants around the country and in the Midwest was the low cost of natural gas. So in the early 2000s, we in the nuclear energy community were really interested in looking forward to expansion of nuclear energy. There were about 30 new power plants proposed. And then between the recession and fracking of natural gas, it completely changed the energy market. And electricity became much cheaper, and it really had an impact on a number of nuclear power plants around the country. And so Kewaunee Nuclear Power Plant was closed down in 2013, largely because they could not secure another long-term power purchase agreement with the local utility.
People have concerns about the safety of nuclear power. What do you say to them to alleviate their concerns, especially with this newer idea of how to build a plant?
So these new designs are working in a lot of new safety concepts. This particular design from NuScale is bringing a lot more of the components of the reactor inside the reactor, so there's less parts that could fail outside the reactor. That has a bunch of, you know, without going into the technical details, it has a number of benefits. But another thing that just makes it a different story to some degree is that it's smaller. And the fact that it's smaller means that the risk from any given reactor is smaller. And NuScale has been able to work with the Nuclear Regulatory Commission to get to the point where they're not going to need an emergency planning zone. And so they'll be able to design this reactor with no expectation of a large release of radiation.
Talking to Paul Wilson, chair of the UW-Madison Department of Engineering Physics, professor of nuclear engineering there, looking at the idea of allowing new nuclear power construction in Wisconsin, a plan, an idea in the works, possibly for the La Crosse area, still in the study stage. You can join in with your thoughts on that. Your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Paul, a concern for many years now has been what to do with nuclear waste. That I said there was an effective ban on new nuclear power plant construction. That was a requirement that there had to be a federally approved waste disposal site. That never happened doesn't seem like it's happening now. This is a long-term argument. The state ended that moratorium. But what about that nuclear waste? Where does it go?
All right, so used nuclear fuel that comes out of reactors today is staying at the sites where it was used. So at Kewaunee, at La Crosse still, at Point Beach, fuel comes out of the reactors. It stays in pools to keep it cool for 5 or 10 years, and then it can be moved to above-ground storage. That above-ground storage is simple and robust and easy to maintain. Certainly, we don't want it there forever, but there's not a lot of technical urgency to move it from where it's sitting right now. It's like I say, it's pretty easy to maintain and store it there, and so that we can explore the right solution in the long term. We know that we will need to build a deep geologic disposal facility. We'll need to put it underground at some point. The Yucca Mountain site in Nevada seems unlikely to ever come to fruition, even though it has a lot of technical merit. But you know, it seems that for a lot of reasons that may never happen. And so we've restarted a new process within the U.S. Framework called a consent-based siting process, where we're aiming to learn how to work with communities so that we can find communities to be willing to host a facility like this, and then we'll store the used nuclear fuel underground.
Now, there's a big concern with climate change, of course, an effort to get away from fossil fuels, the oil, coal, and natural gas, a big effort to boost solar and wind energy. Where do you see nuclear fitting into that picture?
Well, I think they all fit together pretty nicely. When Kewaunee shut down in 2013, it's plain on the record that the emissions of CO2 and climate and greenhouse gases in Wisconsin went up. So whatever aspirations and hopes we had that we would replace the Kewaunee nuclear power plant with renewable energy never came to pass. And so instead, we burn more gas and we burn more coal. And so it's critical to keep the existing reactors open and continuing to operate, because that's been the pattern everywhere in the country and everywhere around the world. We certainly need to be adding more solar and wind, right? Wisconsin has a good climate for wind in some places. It's never going to be a great place for solar, but it certainly is somewhere we should be expanding it. The new O'Brien Fields that UW campus is part of is a great example. And so I think we need to expand solar, we need to expand wind. But there's a growing body of evidence that shows that if we try and rely only on solar and wind, perhaps we can get there, but it's just going to be a really big lift. It's going to be an expensive system. It's just not going to be the best system. We need to pair the solar and the wind and the batteries with other technologies to get the best possible electricity system.
We're talking to UW-Madison nuclear engineering professor Paul Wilson about nuclear energy in Wisconsin. There's a proposal in the early stages looking at the idea of building a smaller nuclear plant in the La Crosse area. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of the idea? What questions do you have for our guest? Do you want to see nuclear play a bigger role in Wisconsin's energy mix or not? And why or why not? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up the conversation now with Paul Wilson, chair of the University of Wisconsin-Madison's Department of Engineering Physics and the Granger Professor of Nuclear Engineering, with us today looking at a proposal for nuclear energy in La Crosse and what it could mean for energy in Wisconsin. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 with your thoughts or your questions. You can also post your thoughts over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Let's go to your calls now. Mark is with us in Jefferson. Mark, hi.
Hi. My main concern with nuclear power is the long-term waste, which I understand can be radioactive for thousands of years and just puts a burden on our future generations. And it's an issue we haven't been able to solve for the last 50 years. So who knows if we'll be able to come up with long-term storage in the next 50 or 100 or 1,000 years.
Mark, thanks for that call. We touched on that a little earlier, Paul. You were more optimistic that we can come up with a solution?
Yeah, I'm fairly optimistic that there's a solution out there. We know how to store it underground. We've designed a repository at Yucca Mountain. We've submitted a license application for that repository. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission has reviewed it. We've collected funds from ratepayers and to pay for it. So we've done everything short of issue the license and start operating that facility. So I'm confident that we can do it. In Finland, they've begun operating a repository underground. Sweden is constructing theirs right now. So I'm confident that it's possible to do that. Now, the other thing that we get by not rushing to it, though, is there are a lot of technical solutions that the nuclear energy community has explored to reprocess and recycle that waste. And while that may not be happening in 5 years or 10 years, there may be a lot of motivation to do that in the future. And so having a little more time to figure out really what the best choice is, knowing that a deep geologic repository is viable, gives us kind of a backstop, but opportunity to explore better options in the interim.
Thanks for the call, Mark. We'll go next to Jerry in Rice Lake. Jerry, hi.
Hi. Say, I just had a question about the NuScale. I think the company was NuScale that right. You mentioned. I see they signed a development agreement of some sort with Dairyland Power. That's a company that burns a lot of coal. And just wondering, is this, how unique is this design? Is this the only company with a small nuclear reactor, or are there companies, other companies in the U.S. or, I don't know, I guess across the globe that are exploring or doing the same design? Just wondered if the professor could give some insight on that.
Jerry, thanks for the call. Paul, are there other players out there?
Yeah, that's a great question. There are 40 or 50 different private companies that have emerged in the last decade, all pursuing different advanced reactor designs of different sizes. In the last 5 years, I think the most exciting thing is companies looking at microreactors, maybe even smaller than this NuScale design. But within the scope of this NuScale design, there's 10 or 15 companies that are looking at similar sized reactors. But what we see in this last period is a flourishing of companies looking at new ideas, old ideas, things that maybe work better today than they tried in the past, and coming up with reactors at a lot of different scales, and allows nuclear energy to participate in our energy system in a way that it really hasn't in the past.
Thanks for that call. Jerry mentioned Dairyland relies a lot on coal. Wisconsin has historically been a coal-heavy state when it comes to electricity production. Do you see this as a road out of that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, to get rid of coal, we're going to have to switch to something else. In the near term, we're going to want something reliable. As we build up more wind and solar, again, I think that's a great idea, but we're going to want to match it with energy that we can rely on being there when we need it. And nuclear is a great choice. Without this, what's going to happen if we move away from coal is going to be burning more gas. From a climate change perspective, that's half of a win, but it's not a whole win. And so we're going to want to look at other technologies like nuclear, wind, and solar as the recipe to get us all the way there and reduce our carbon footprint.
Thanks for that call. We'll go next to Steve in Lake Mills. Steve, hello.
Hello. Northern Wisconsin has geologic deposits in northern Wisconsin that are superb for the storage of deep nuclear waste. We could store it in northern Wisconsin. Is there anybody talking about that? And seems to me as though it would be a boon for our economy. We could make millions of dollars in that process. Thank you.
Steve, thanks for the call. Paul, anybody talking about northern Wisconsin as a possible nuclear waste repository?
40 years ago, there was some discussion about that. As the country narrowed down the sites of interest in the federal program to do this, it sort of fell off the map. I don't know if there's an active community up there looking to this, but it is something that's possible. And again, I'll mention this consent-based siting program is a program that is looking to engage with communities in a really meaningful way. Help them understand whether it's an interesting option for them. You know, I expect that many of the communities that engage in consent-based siting may, after they learn more, decide they're not interested, but there may be communities who decide that they are. It could bring some financial benefit. There's sort of interesting new ideas being considered about how to do that engagement and how to understand what is it a community is going to get beyond finances benefit, right? I think there's a long history of kind of paying communities to take these kinds of hazards on. And I think the consent-based siting process and some of the partners I'm working with are looking at how do we actually combine this in ways with things that communities actually want, and not just paying them off, but actually allowing them to have economic development, allowing them to have resurgence in other parts of their economy in conjunction with this kind of opportunity.
Thanks for that call. Mike joins us now in Wausau. Mike, hello.
Hi. I was curious. Years ago, there was a new technology for reactors called a pebble reactor, where the fuel is coated in ceramic balls. And then if something happens, that all the pebbles kind of fall out into a holding areas and separate so the reaction stops.
Mike, thanks for the call. I think the phrase pebble bed reactor sticks in my head, Paul. Has that become a thing?
Yeah, no, that's still under pretty active development. In fact, we have a, like I mentioned, there's a lot of these companies pursuing different things. One of those companies is somebody called X Energy. They have won a big federal grant to build a demonstration plant in Eastern Washington. And so they're working towards building a plant that I think will be two or three times bigger than one of these new scale reactors. But they're relying on these pebbles, just as the caller said, very tiny little, specks of the uranium fuel that then get compressed into a ball of graphite, same size as a billiard ball. And then hundreds of thousands of those fill the reactor and move through the reactor over time to create the reaction.
Thanks for that call, Paul. In just our last minute or so, I know this plant in the La Crosse area is in the very early stages. What, assuming all approvals went through and things like that, what would be the timeline to go from now to a functioning nuclear power plant?
Well, so I mean, it's more than just approvals, right? Mm-hmm. I think Darryl and Power needs to consider this and decide they want to go ahead. And we can't estimate how long that's going to be. Because they're going to have business considerations and so on. I think from the moment they decided they wanted to go forward, it would still be a number of years till we had a reactor in place. NuScale is planning to build the first of their reactors in Eastern Idaho near Idaho National Lab to be owned by a consortium of cooperatives over in Utah and Idaho called UAMPS. They will be the owners of this reactor. And it will be operated perhaps by Xcel Energies from based in Minnesota. And so we'll see these, and the plan is for them to be in operation in a few years. And so those will be the first of the kind. And then if Darryl and Power to go ahead, they would be able to follow on the footsteps of that and fairly quickly, I think. But that's the other thing, is that the idea is to build these reactors fairly quickly in a controlled factory environment rather than on-site as large infrastructure projects, which, like any large infrastructure projects, are always plagued by delays.
Paul, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. Glad to talk to you.
That's Paul Wilson, nuclear engineering professor at UW-Madison, with us for a look at nuclear energy in Wisconsin, the possibility of new, smaller reactors, including an idea for one near La Crosse. March 2020, people in a wide array of office jobs found themselves working from home for the first time. While many companies reopened their offices, more employees who can do their job from home say they want to keep that flexibility. Hope Kerwin has more on how workers and their employers are thinking about the future of the workplace.
Marchita Wynn from Middleton was already working from home several days a week before the pandemic hit in 2020. She's an editor at a Madison-based nonprofit that does book and magazine publishing. On days she went to the office, DeWynn says her morning routine was a rush of activity.
Take the dog out, go back in, and, get my bag and jump into the car and set off for the workplace, which is, on a good day, is 30 minutes away.
Like many office workers, DeWynn's routine was turned upside down by COVID-19. In-person meetings became Zoom calls, and hallway conversations with colleagues became email exchanges. And DeWynn enjoyed the changes. She liked not having to burn fossil fuels by driving across town, and she liked getting to spend more time with her aging dog.
I like that it's quiet. I think I was better able to deal with the noise level at the workplace than many of my coworkers, but boy, it really makes a difference.
The perks were enough that even though many of her colleagues are going back to the office, DeWynn says she wants to continue working from home. And she's not alone. A national survey by Pew Research Center found that 59% of American workers who can do their job from home were working remotely all or most of the time in January. Of that group, 61% say that's by choice. Krista Kirsch teaches business management at the University of Wisconsin-La Crosse. She says the pandemic challenged the long-held assumption that office work needed to be done in an office.
Now that that opportunity is clearly available, you can't take that away. Like, you can't unknow that. So I think that's going to be a big long-lasting factor.
Kirsch says the pandemic has made workers more aware of how their job affects their personal life, like the cost of their daily commute or the time taken away from family and friends. And with the tight labor market, employees are more comfortable voicing their preferences. She says, in general, studies support hybrid work, where people have the ability to work from home but are also coming into an office.
Assuming that a job is doable in that format, the research suggests that that job will get done better in a hybrid format than in a fully face-to-face format or even in a fully telework format.
Trane Technologies is an HVAC and refrigeration manufacturer in La Crosse that's embracing these changes. Last summer, Trane announced plans to sell one of their office buildings and have employees who started working from home during the pandemic continue to do so. Business operations director Marty Frank says Trane was beginning to offer more flexibility in where people worked before the pandemic, especially for workers with special skills like being bilingual.
Flexibility is one of those things that we saw as a competitive advantage for recruiting people. It was also something we wanted to offer our employees to maintain and retain the best employees. And we kept edging into more flexibility, and then COVID hit.
While employees in Trane's lab and manufacturing plant continued to come into work, most of the company's cubicles were suddenly empty. These days, Frank said only about 10% of office workers in the building they plan to sell are coming in at least once a week. They're hoping to have more people back in their offices starting in April, when they plan to start what the company is calling the future of work. In order to motivate employees to come back, Frank says they're planning major updates to the office they're keeping, from better lighting to adjustable desks with privacy screens. And they're getting feedback from their employees through an annual engagement survey. Frank sees all of these changes as part of a bigger evolution to office work.
In my management career of 30 years, I would say flexibility wouldn't have never entered into the first 10 years, 15 years of that experience. Everybody came to work 5 days a week. You came dressed up in dress pants and a nice shirt. Today's work environment's a little different.
He says employers like Trane will have to find a way to balance their needs with what their current and potential employees are looking for in a workplace. Working from my home in La Crosse, this is Hope Kerwin for Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up after the news is our current 40-year high in the rate of inflation, just a bump in the road. We'll hear what the Fed thinks and how it's planning to do what it can to cool the economy by raising the interest rate. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, some paleontologists disagree with how we categorize the Tyrannosaurus rex. We'll talk to a dinosaur expert from here in Wisconsin. Now, just out today from the Federal Reserve, the first raise in the key interest rate in several years, 0.25%. That came out today, along with a look at key indicators about the current and future state of the American economy. Fed Chair Jerome Powell spoke at a press conference shortly after the projections were released following a two-day meeting of their policy committee. Here's a little of what Powell had to say during the question and answer period.
It's clearly time to raise interest rates and begin the balance sheet shrinkage. And I just wanted to say that as I looked around the table at today's meeting, I saw a committee that's acutely aware of the need to return the economy to price stability and determined to use our tools to do exactly that.
We're going to dig into what all of that means, and you could join in at 800-642-1234. The interest rates have been low for quite a while. Has that affected you when it comes to borrowing money to buy a house, a car, go to school, you name it? Are you worried about the impact of inflation? Did you want to see some action taken at the federal level? What questions do you have about how inflation links to things like our employment level here in the country? You could join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can email ideas@wpr.org. Kevin Barr is professor of finance and chief analyst for the Center for Business and Economic Insight at UW-Stevens Point. Kevin, welcome back to Central Time.
Rob, nice to be here. Thank you very much.
All right. What is this interest rate? What does it mean when the Fed nudges it up?
Okay, so what the Federal Reserve does, they target this very short-term interest rate. It's called the Fed funds rate. And when they change this rate, there's basically a rippling effect through the United States economy. So, for example, when they increase this rate, you can expect to see interest rates go up on consumer loans, on mortgages, and eventually also really on savings deposits. So there's basically, when they change this rate, there's a rippling effect throughout the entire economy. Now, one thing I should say as far as this rate and the increase today, the Federal Reserve had this rate targeted at between 0 and 0.25%, which is incredibly historically low. If you go back over the last 75 years in the United States, this interest rate was only this low one other time, and that was right after the financial crisis in 2008. What the Federal Reserve does, they try to lower this rate when the economy is struggling, like during the financial crisis, and then in 2020, during COVID, and then they will typically ramp up the rate when the economy starts coming back. So for example, back in 2010, we started this extremely long period of economic growth. When you got to 2018, the Fed funds rate was between 2.25% and 2.5%. So as far as an increased rate today, yes, that was expected. Yes, it can counter inflation to some extent, but there are other factors going on, and we can talk about those other factors. But interest rates have just been historically low. So an interest rate increase, very expected.
Right. And I was looking at a chart of interest rates over, I think, the last 40 years. And even after those nudge ups you mentioned after the Great Recession, it's still just like really, really low when you compare it to what it had been for decades before that.
Yeah, you know, one thing, I mean, if you're relatively young, you don't remember. However, I do remember the Fed funds rate, if you go back to the turn of the century, was at 6%. One of the strongest decades in economic growth ever for the United States was back in the 1990s. And a lot of that had to do with the advent of the internet and tech companies growing very rapidly. You had GDP growth in excess of 4% several years. And the Fed funds rate over the last half of that decade, typically between 5 and 6%. So what we've experienced really over the last 10, 15 years is just really historically low. It just typically doesn't operate like that.
Okay, now let's look at why the Fed is doing this. I think it's mostly inflation. How does the interest rate relate to inflation?
Okay, excellent question. Not exactly an easy answer.
What my job's easier than yours. What can I say?
It's a much easier question to ask. I mean, it's a lot easier to ask the question than give the answer. But when the Federal Reserve increases the interest rate, you know, it increases borrowing costs for consumers. It increases borrowing costs for corporations. So that will have the tendency to temper demand. So you lower demand relative to a given supply, and then prices start to back off. Now, that being said, in the last couple of years, we've had some extraordinary things go on in the United States. It's not just demand or government spending that's driving inflation. It's basically supply chain issues. That's been a biggie. And you've also had energy prices that have really kind of gone through the roof. Energy prices are up over 25% in the United States in the past year. They're up over 25% in the European Union as well. I mean, it's basically a global increase in energy prices. Now, typically you expect energy prices to kind of go up really after you have a sudden turnaround, very rapid economic growth after a downturn, because it takes a while for energy supplies to kind of get ramped up. Inventories were drawn down during 2020. But then you add to that basically the Russian invasion of the Ukraine. And so there are some things about inflation that the Federal Reserve can control, like demand. But when it comes to the supply side, like the supply chain stuff, you know, the Russian invasion of Ukraine and how that has impacted oil prices, there's really not an awful lot they can do about that.
We're talking to finance professor Kevin Barr from UW Stevens Point, looking at the Federal Reserve bumping up the interest rate, the very low, as he was saying, interest rate, plans to do some more of that through the year, part of an effort to target inflation. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question about what this means, but what it means for you about inflation? And are you feeling the effects of inflation? Do you think something needs to be done here? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Kevin, you mentioned some of the things that bumping up this interest rate will affect and things that people might interact with. for consumers, what does an increase in the interest rate, possibly more to come this year, mean for some of their activities they might do? A house hunting, car buying, that kind of stuff.
House hunting, car buying, consumer loans, are the interest rate on consumer loans you can expect to increase. You can expect mortgage rates to increase. The Federal Reserve also said a couple of other interesting things today in terms of they not only said that they're increasing interest rates currently by 25 basis points or 0.25%. So that would put the Fed funds rate at a level, targeted level of between 0.25 and 0.5%. However, then they also went on to state that they have a projection for the Fed funds of about between 1.75 and 2% by the end of 2022, and perhaps between 2.75 and 3% by the end of 2023. So in other words, you can expect multiple rate increases, kind of a gradual ramp up in interest rates, not only by the Fed, but also on consumer loans, if you're going to purchase big ticket items, and also on mortgage rates. You can expect that to start to ramp up fairly soon and continue for the next couple of years.
Now, in that clip we heard from Jerome Powell, head of the Fed, he mentioned raising interest rates and also the balance sheet shrinkage. Now, the Fed had been investing in some stuff that was aimed at boosting the economy. What's going on there? What's that part of the story?
They kind of pretty much go hand in hand. When the Federal Reserve buys these, they buy treasury securities, and they buy treasury securities and they pump more money into the United States economy, which has the tendency to make credit easier to get. That also will put a downward pressure on interest rates. When they take money out of the economy, which is basically what they would be proposing to do when they're winding down their purchase of treasury securities or selling treasury securities, they're taking money out of the economy. So they're making credit conditions a little bit tighter, a little bit harder to get, and that can also put some upper pressure on interest rates. But typically, that what they do with their government purchases pretty much goes closely hand in hand with what they're doing with the Fed funds rate.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Thomas is with us in Milwaukee. Thomas, hi.
Hey, obviously, we've felt the 300 plus dollar heating bill for the last few months, the up in gas and whatnot, but the that's internal. Speaking about the sort of implications of the external like impacts on the economy, what are the impacts if the U.S. status's petrodollar ceases, something like that? How drastic potentially could something like that happening? I heard that the King Prince of Saudi Arabia is floating that idea around of switching to the Chinese currency. I don't know if you guys have heard anything about that, or, that's my question.
Thomas, thanks for the call. Yeah, talks apparently between Saudi Arabia and China saying we would accept payment in yuan, the Chinese currency, instead of just the dollar. I'm pretty sure they'd still take dollars. What do you think of that? Would that be something that would affect us, Kevin, in the prices we pay?
It can affect the value of the dollar or the strength of the dollar relative to foreign currencies if you have another foreign currency basically accepted as payment, which then in turn would affect the price of exports and imports. If the dollar becomes weaker, then it basically would mean that anything that when I say the dollar would become weaker because now you have another currency in demand, if the dollar becomes weaker, then anything that we would import becomes relatively more expensive and could be passed along to consumers. Where this goes a lot of this stuff I think can also get to be political as far as, accepting another currency rather than the United States dollar. I think, though, your caller brings up an excellent point. There are so many factors that play into this little sort of inflation puzzle that we have going on right now that it's really extremely difficult to predict where things are going over the next year or two. Another thing I kind of want to throw out If you look at oil prices, oil price futures are down about 20% since just the beginning of March. And now one of the things that appears to be affecting oil markets is the fact that you have another COVID outbreak in China. Well, if you have a COVID outbreak in China and China shuts things down pretty quickly, well, China is basically the number two user of crude oil right behind the United States. Well, if that lessens the demand for crude oil, okay, oil prices will then come down as the futures market has done. But then that could also disrupt the supply chain even more. We basically import about 20% of our imports come from China. So you got a lot of different factors that are going on that are going to affect, that could affect prices.
Thanks for that call, Thomas. We're talking to Kevin Barr, professor of finance and chief analyst for the Center for Business Economic Insight at the University of Wisconsin. Stevens Point, the Fed announced a 0.25% raise in the key interest rate today. We're talking what that means, what it means for inflation, and you can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts on that, your questions about what it means, your solution, if any, to inflation. Call 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our talk with Kevin Barr, professor of finance and chief analyst for the Center for Business and Economic Insight at UW Stevens Point, looking at the Fed's announcement today that it will raise the interest rate to help manage inflation. Let's go back to your calls at 800-642-1234. Miles is with us in Green Bay. Miles, hi.
Hi.
What'd you want to bring up, Miles?
I just wanted to ask, I seem to remember, like, in the year or so leading up to COVID, there were conversations around raising the interest rates that I think Trump kind of put pressure on the Fed to avoid raising the interest rates back then. And I just wanted to know, I mean, obviously COVID had the biggest impact on anything that's going on right now, but how much of an impact could that have maybe had? I mean, would anything be any different if the Fed had been able to raise rates when things were going better?
Miles, thanks for the call. There were some increases in 2018, maybe not as much as some people wanted. I think, Kevin, what do you think of Miles's question?
Excellent question, Miles. You had a couple of things going on toward the end of the last decade. In 2016, I believe it was, the Federal Reserve actually did start to increase interest rates from that 0 to 0.25% historically low rate that they had put in place after the financial crisis. So it was kind of a gradual increase in interest rates 2017, then again 2018. I believe it peaked at between 2.25 and 2.5%. And as Miles points out, there was pressure put on by the Trump administration. But again, the Federal Reserve is supposed to act in an independent manner. Kind of the big thing that was going on in 2019, you had this sort of fairly significant trade war that the United States had with, you know, pick a country, and we may very well have had tariffs with them. It's not only China, but also Canada, the EU, whatever. And so there was a concern that all that trade war stuff was going to have an economic slowdown on the United States. And so consequently, interest rates started to come down in 2019. And again, they bottomed out with COVID, but you had kind of, the ramp up did start in 2016, but then it was reversed in 2019, and a lot of that had to do with the tariffs, the tariff war.
Thanks for the call, Miles. Doug joins us now in Colfax. Doug, hello.
Hello. I'm wondering about some of the reporting about inflation being somewhat elevated because of all the government payments for COVID. Most of us got that. A lot of us spent it. And that may have some effect on driving up interest rates and, I mean, inflation. And I'm wondering if that may reduce the future interest rate hikes of 2.5 or whatever next year.
Doug, thanks a lot for that call. And Doug's getting into an issue I hadn't brought up yet, Kevin, fiscal policy, putting a lot of money in people's hands for COVID relief. How big a part of the inflation story was that?
Okay, well, there's a couple of different ways to look at it. Number one, there's no doubt that the COVID relief and the government programs that were basically put in place with COVID, that did increase consumer demand. You had unemployment go from 14.7% basically in April 2020. Now it's down to about 3.8%. You had 152 million people employed in the United States before the COVID hit. the net was dramatically reduced down to 130 million. Now it's back up to 150 million. So we're still a little bit less. So there's a couple of different ways that you can look at it. Yes, consumer demand definitely came back. Consumer demand came back, but supply didn't come back. So that's where you get the imbalance. We didn't have any, you had 152 million people employed, relatively low inflation before COVID. Well, what changed with a couple of million fewer people employed now, but now you have this 7.9% inflation. Well, what's the difference? And a lot of that's got to do with the supply chain. And we've also kind of had the labor market has impacted this as well, because you've had a tightening of the labor market. You've had various issues in the labor market between people not always feeling comfortable and working during COVID versus perhaps feeling a disrespect by customers versus just being burned out and stressed out, particularly if you're in healthcare, if you're in elementary or secondary education. So a number of factors, I think, do play into this.
Thanks for that call. Mike joins us now in Green Bay. Mike, hi.
Hey.
What did you want to bring up, Mike?
A couple questions. So I think you mentioned something about 20% imports from China. Are you talking about oil imports, or from my perspective, you need to go into any store like consumer products, and I mean, just to gander, I'd say 50% of it's made in China or somewhere to that extent. And then my second question was how much inflation related to oil prices. So, fact of fiction, Russia, we only import, 10% maybe?
I gotcha. Mike, I don't have a great signal, but I think we got your questions. First of all, Mike thinks that 20% of imports, coming from China sounds low to him. We have pretty big trading partners north and south of our borders, right?
Yeah, the 20% figure that I threw out, that has got to do with import of goods, not import of oil. The United States does import some oil, but it's really not from China. China imports a lot more oil than what they export. They consume a lot more than what they produce. So China is basically an oil importer. So we're not getting the oil from China. That 20% figure that I threw out is basically from it has to do with goods that we get from China. When we are importing oil, and the way this has evolved, the United States is much less dependent upon oil now than what it was, say, 50 years ago during the oil embargo of 1973. We are actually a net exporter of petroleum products, but we do import crude oil to some degree. So it's like we can take the crude oil, we'll refine it, make it into different petroleum products, and export that. So we're actually a net exporter of petroleum products. If we do need oil, we can turn to the north and go to Canada for oil. So that the one thing I think I heard part of the question as far as energy prices and how does that relate mm-hmm. to inflation. Basically, recent inflation is accounted for by about a third of that inflation is due to the increase in energy prices. But even that's kind of an understatement, because once you have an increase in energy prices, just about everything that you buy is delivered by truck. And so prices will go up because of the energy prices. And I also wanted to maybe throw out another thing that we haven't really talked about as far as this overall inflation stuff. 2021 corporate profits were at record levels. They were 30% higher than what they were back in 2018. So that's another reason why you've had this tick up in inflation. Yes, costs have gone up, but in many cases, prices have gone up to a greater extent than what the costs have gone up to corporations.
Kevin, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
My pleasure, Rob. Anytime. Thank you very much.
We're talking to Kevin Barr, professor of finance and chief analyst for the Center for Business and Economic Insight at the University of Wisconsin, Stevens Point. He joined us today for a look at the Fed's announcement that came out this afternoon, officially that it's raising the interest rate a bit. The levels still stay low. What those moves mean for our economy going forward and what they mean for you. Still time for you to share your thoughts. You can always tweet us at Central Time WPR. That's at Central Time WPR on Twitter. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent. Sometimes we think of our brains as being like computers or cameras, and they just capture all those memories coming in. That's not really how they work. So how do our minds handle memory? And even how do our brains understand reality itself? Learn about some of the latest brain science, what we know about how memory works. That's tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. You can join in the conversation yourself. We all just set our clocks ahead this weekend, or if we didn't, we've had some serious trouble showing up on time for appointments, but this time it might stay sprung forward. A vote in the U.S. Senate approved a plan to keep us in daylight savings time. Excuse me, daylight saving time. I always want to throw that extra S in there. That's the thing we're in right now. Keep that forever. Still have to go through the U.S. House and the White House. Well, as reported in the Smithsonian Magazine, we did this before in the early 1970s. And as popular as the idea is, it didn't go perfectly. And the government ended that experiment. We went back, as you know, to the clock changes. The big objection under the daylight saving time, it stays dark later in the morning. Not so bad in the summer. In the winter, a bummer. Kids went to school in the dark, dark of the morning. Same with early commuters. The reaction to that led to the return of the twice annual switch. What do you think? Do you want one clock to rule them all? Email centraltime at WPR.org or tweet us at centraltimewpr. This is Central Time.